The holiday of Purim, as we know, is one of the deepest holidays in the Jewish calendar. Rabbis tell us that even Las Tilavo, in the future times, we will still have Megillas Esther, the Scroll of Esther, the celebration of the Purim story, because the lessons of Purim are not only for the time that we're living in now, but their implications will go on forever. There are many aspects to the holiday of Purim to be discussed, to be analyzed, lessons to be derived. I'd like to try, with God's help, in this particular shiur, in this particular class, to focus in on one aspect of the holiday of Purim, really specific laws that are found specifically on Purim, and try to understand their deeper meaning, their deeper message, and clearly the lessons that we are to learn for our lives. I'd like to begin with two questions. One, a very general question, and the other, a much more specific one. The general question, as stated in the Gevurot Yitzchak, but it's a question that almost everyone asks, the Tzarich Biur Lama Tiknu Mitzvot Mishloch Manot U'Matanot Lavyonim B'Purim Shelo Matzinu Dugmato B'Shum Yontov. What is it about Purim that we have specifically the laws of Matanas Lavyonim, the laws of giving gifts to the poor, and Mishloch Manot, of sending gifts of food to people? Why is it specifically on Purim that we are commanded to be involved in these two endeavors? What is the significance that on, let's say, Shavuos or Pesach or Sukkot, we're not told to give gifts of food to people? We're not told specifically that beforehand we should be giving out a lot of money for people, L'tzarchei Achag? Though we find it, to some degree, the intensity and the command that is found in Purim is really unique. And that's really the overarching question I'd like to deal with, is what is it about Purim that demands, so to speak, this concept of gift-giving, this concept of really having an open hand with the poor and the needy? The second question is based on that famous song, the famous poem, Shoshanas Yaakov, that we sing after Kriyas Megillah. And we state in the song of the rose of Yaakov was cheerful and glad when they jointly saw Mordechai robed in royal blue. You have been their eternal salvation, their hope throughout generations, to make known that all who hope in you will not be shamed, nor ever be humiliated, those taking refuge in you. And then it gets to the specific parts of the story, and Shoshanas Yaakov continued, a curse be Haman, who sought to destroy me. Blessed be Mordechai the Yehudi. A curse be Zeresh, the wife of my terrorizer. Blessed be Esther, who sacrificed for me, and Chavona too, be remembered for good. The question that's asked, and that Chaim brings us down, is we do not seem to see a parallelism between Haman and Mordechai as we see between Zeresh and Esther. Zeresh is described as the wife of my terrorizer, while Esther is one who sacrificed for me. But by Haman and Mordechai, we don't have a balanced state. Haman is described as one who sought to destroy me, but Mordechai is just described as the Yehudi, as the Jew, not one who is trying to save for God's sake. So how do we understand the balance of Haman seeking to destroy me, paralleling with just the description of Mordechai, who is the Yehudi? How is it, how are we to understand that the word Yehudi is, in and of its own right, a balance to the one who sought to destroy me? Before getting into the specifics of the concept of Mishloach Manot, I'd like to step back and take really a forest view of the concept of Mishloach Manot, and then with God's help enter into two specific deeper analyses and understanding of what Mishloach Manot is all about. The first overview I'd like to do is from an art scroll book, Seasons of the Soul, and an article entitled Why Purim by Rabbi Elkanah Schwartz. And he says so beautifully that the fundamental to Jewish belief is recognition of divine control of the universe where there are no accidents. And he describes that which we know, that the divine control functions in two patterns, what we would call teva, nature, and nace, miracle. And nature really means that the Almighty moves everything in a predictable order. And we describe as natural those events that occur by divine control within this order. And the miracle means something that's supernatural, something that's unnatural. And we know within the realm of miracle, we have the Nes Nigla, the divine miracle which is revealed, and the Nes Nistar, the divine control which is hidden. And the miracles made to appear as a natural occurrence. And he notes that the Purim story is clearly a story wherein one would feel that this is a natural occurrence. And perhaps while the story was taking place, it was looked at as these are a series of unnatural events occurring one after the other. But clearly in stepping back, Mordechai, the Anshei Knesset, Agdola, and Esther came to teach us that in reality we have to recognize that he is truly directing the circumstances surrounding individual and collective lives along patterns destined for their benefit. Though one may not at the time be aware of it, just as Mordechai and Esther and the other Jews of the time were initially not aware of the miraculous nature of the natural appearing events of the time, now that Purim has been identified as a miracle, it's to be treated as such. And the miracle of Purim is not just a specific miracle of Purim, it really serves as a model for us. It serves as a model of the famous concept, where can we find Esther indicated in the Torah? And the answer is the verse, Haster Aster Panai Bayom Ahu, where God says, I will surely hide my face on this day. And it's a reference where God is saying to Moshe that there will come a time that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God, is going to really guide the Jews through all the tribulations that may befall them, except that his hand may not be revealed in the process. It's the Hester Panim, the hidden face, which is also a process of divine guidance. That's the story of Purim. The story of Purim, the story which does not have God's name mentioned in the entire Megillah and the entire story, is a story where clearly God's hand is leading and directing, controlling every aspect, every facet of the story. Although it's nistar, it's hidden, we do not see this clearly in our eyes. And the impetus that we need to take from the Purim story and the inspiration we need to take from the Purim story is to be able to see God all year round as that Hester Panim, as he's hiding his face, but to be able to clearly see him behind the mask. If we understand that the Purim story is really a time of concealment where we do not understand God, so says Rabbi Schwartz in this essay, we can then understand the mitzvahs of Purim. As he explains, on every other holiday, there are unique mitzvahs that are really only found on that holiday, like a lulav and esrog and sukkos, like matzah and pesach. They're unique to that particular holiday, blowing of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Well, the mitzvahs of Purim, really, if you think about it, are nothing really so unique. A suda, a meal, we have every Shabbos and Yom Tov. Megillah, there are other times during the year we read Megillah. Kohelet, Rut, Eicha, for example. Giving gifts to people, well, we do give gifts to people. You go to someone's house for Shabbat, you give them a bottle of wine, a cake, whatever it may be. And gifts to the poor, there's a big mitzvah stukah. So says this essay, Why Purim? That in reality, all of the mitzvahs on Purim have the common denominator of being something that's natural. And then he says, and I quote, if Purim is a celebration of a miracle disguised as a natural event, then the fulfillment of Purim should also appear as something natural, although in reality it is not. One must be aware while listening to the reading of the Megillah, sending food packages to friends, giving gifts to the poor, or enjoying a festive meal, that all appear quote-unquote natural, but in reality are not. Instead, one must be mindful of loftier meanings. It is simpler to be reminded of faith when doing something exotic. It is more difficult to be so reminded when we're doing something ordinary. But then, once reminded, the ordinary becomes extraordinary. And I think this is a wonderful description of these mitzvahs of Matanos Lavyonim and Mishloach Manot. They seem so ordinary. To give gifts to other people, to give money to the poor, it seems to be such a natural and ordinary thing. But that's the whole point of Purim. That which seems to be so natural, that which seems to be on the level of Teva, on the level of nature, the Kunz of Purim is really behind all of that. It's a Nes Nistar. It's the hidden miracle hand of God controlling our lives. And therefore, when we do these quote-unquote natural events, we need to be cognizant of the fact that there's a deeper meaning here, that there's much that lies behind these natural acts that really have a tremendous amount of significance and symbolism. So that just further begs our question, well, what is the symbolism of Mishloach Manot and Matanos Lavyonim, of giving gifts to people and gifts to the poor? How are we to unveil the ordinary and be able to explain and understand the extraordinary? So continuing in our Faris view, we know some very famous reasons are given for these gifts. One reason, which Matnat Chaim quotes, a very famous reason, is the reason of the Manos HaLevi, which explains that one of the key themes in the Megillah is the theme of unity, where Esther says, Lechnosa kol Yehudim, gather the people, and describes how the people gather together in order to fight for their lives. And it's really also a counterbalance to Haman, who describes the Jews as an Am Echad Mefuzar Mefarad Ben Amim, that's separate, that's disunified among the nations. So we come together on Purim as almost a counter to that which Haman said, to model that which the Jews did, and to gather together and to become one. Nevertheless, this also has to be understood. Just because they gather together, that's enough of a reason to send food to other people, it needs a further explanation. We also know a reason that's brought down in Daf Chochma Musar of Yerucham Alevi, who speaks about the famous Arizal, that Yom Kippur is a day like Purim, and Yom Kippur and Purim have a lot in common. And he notes that one of the aspects of Yom Kippur is a Yom Slicha Mechila, a day of forgiveness, a day of complete atonement from God. And it's a day that's described She'ein bo lo kina v'lo sinna v'lo tachrut, v'sholetet bo ava achva v'reyit. It's a day without animosity, it's a day without jealousy, it's a day that's filled with love and brotherhood and friendship. Today we sit in shul all day and we have this feeling of community where we don't feel any of this animosity between people. We start with a clean slate. Yom Kippur being a day like Purim, likewise Purim has that same aspect. It's a day of Ava Sabrios, it's a day of love of mankind. And it's interesting that Rabbi Rucham notes, Pelayowitz also brings this down, that he says, Mi'ikarei ha-mitzvah hu shishlach l'mi sheyesh lo tina v'kpida alav. Says Rabbeinu Yerucham that the real, one of the central motifs and aspects of sending Mishloach Manot, these gifts of food, should be to send to people who we perhaps feel a certain amount of animosity toward them during the course of the year. People perhaps who we hold a grudge on some level. We don't get along with 100%. We all have people who are not on our favorite list, so to speak, and whatever, we maybe avoid these people, perhaps we're really angry at these people. This is a group of people and we really need to focus in sending Mishloach Manot, because the time of Purim is not just to send to friends. That's very nice to increase that relationship, but it has to be deeper than that. It has to be to create a feeling of community, a feeling of friendship, even for those people who perhaps you don't feel that close to. Purim is a time to reach out. Purim is a time to bridge these gaps. And in fact, the very famous Bach that explains that the whole point of Mishloach Manot is in order to enjoy this relationship, v'lashkin b'neim ava v'achva v'reyus, to increase this friendship and this love. That's why perhaps we have all these innovative Purim shuttles and Mishloach Manot creative aspects that people come up with, because we want people to feel good. We want people to be excited. So we do things that are going to increase this love and this friendship and this unity. But once again, the question needs to be asked, what is it about Purim that demands such love, that demands such a relationship one to each other? So I'd like to try to explain our two different interpretations, analysis, of the meaning of these gifts and the gifts to the poor on Purim, that perhaps will give us a deeper insight when we do send these gifts, and perhaps what we should be thinking about. And I think that the structure of the two ideas can really be found in a very fascinating explanation of the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, in a verse toward the end of the Megillah, the end of the story. The verse says, V'tichtov Esther Amalka bat Avichayo l'Mordechai Yehudi,
that both Esther and Mordechai wrote at Kol Tokef L'Kayem Et Igeret HaPurim Hazot HaSheni. They sent out these letters, that these letters should be upheld of the Purim story. And they sent out these letters to the Jews of the 127 provinces of Malchut HaKashveros. And these Igeret, this letter, is described as Divrei Shalom Ve'emes. Words, literally words of peace, of Shalom Ve'emes, and of truth. And the Gra explains that the Divrei Shalom, the words of peace, he HaMegillah Sheshalchu, the Megillah itself, the scroll, the story itself, really embodies the concept of Shalom, the concept of peace. And Ve'emes, the concept of truth, of Divrei Shalom Ve'emes, is He HaTorah SheKiblu Et HaTorah Ba'Ava Rabba, B'Limo Da'Ava Ones. It's the concept of the ability on Purim that we know that the Jewish people re-accepted the Torah. Aside from the original acceptance at Mount Sinai, here is a second acceptance of Kimu V'Kiblu. They re-accepted that which they had previously accepted in the times of Achashverosh. That's the aspect of truth. So we need to understand what the meaning of this Gra is. Both statements seem on the outset to be puzzling. How do we see the Megillah to embody the concept of Shalom, the concept of peace? Perhaps you may argue that it's the peace that reigned finally between the Jews and their neighbors. Well, it didn't seem like there was animosity till Haman walked on the scene. And then at the end of the story, there are a lot of people dying. I don't know if we focus in on that much. But the numbers come into the thousands. Is that the level of peace that we're speaking about, that ultimately they vanquished their enemies? Perhaps. Perhaps it means something quite different, which we'll try to examine. The second question is, the MS, the truth, is a reference to the Torah. What does it exactly mean that the reacceptance of the Torah is this aspect of MS, this aspect of truth? So the first analysis, moving into the aspect now of the trees, like to do is based on the writings of Rabbi Solomon, Matnat Chaim, Mashkiach, the Lakewood Yeshiva. And the second analysis will be based on the Gvuros Yitzchak, Rabbi Tzaratskin, Avram Yitzchak Tzaratskin of the Tel Yeshiva. The Matnat Chaim, in his essay, will do selections of it on Mishloch Banot, begins with a very interesting preface, which is really key not only to Purim, but is really key to life and something we really need to instill within ourselves much more, perhaps, than we normally do. The Matnat Chaim explains that we really need to have a clear understanding of how the Torah views mitzvot ben adam l'chaveiro, commandments between man and one's fellow man. And he brings a fascinating insight of the Beit Elohim that notes that our rabbis tell us that there were two sides of the Lucho, two sides of the tablets that were given from God to Moshe to the people. We know, there's a very famous idea, that one side were the mitzvos ben adam l'makom, between man and God, to believe in God, not to have any other idols, not to swear falsely, keep the Shabbat. And the second set of the Luchot, of the tablets, were mitzvos, were commandments between man and one fellow man. Lo tirtach, not to kill, lo tignov, not to commit kidnapping, lo tinaf, not to commit adultery, and things in relationship between man and one's fellow man. But there is an idea in Chazal that the two sides of the Luchot, the two sides of the tablets, were balanced in appearance, which means that that which took X amount of lines on one side took the same amount of lines on the other. But the question is an obvious question, and this is the Hara, this is the insight of the Beit Elohim, that if you look at the text, so the side between man and God has far more words than the side between man and man. While we have Anochi Hashem Elokecha, who took us out of the land of Egypt from the house of slavery, you have two words, Lo Tirtzah, don't kill, or Lo Tachmo, don't covet. So they're really not balanced. So how are we to say that they were balanced when they're not balanced? One has far more words than the other. So he explains the following. He explains that the letters were written much bigger on the side of between man and man in order to compensate for the balance of space. So that which took let's say, two lines on one side, so the words Lo Tirtzach were written of those full two lines. What does this mean on a much deeper level? So explains the Matnat Chaim very simply. Conceptually, the fact that these were written much bigger is to come to teach us that it is far more difficult to keep the laws between man and man than the laws between man and God. And therefore, the laws between man and man had to be, so to speak, bolded, had to be really elaborated in large letters in order for us to focus in on them and to be aware of their importance. And as the Matnat Chaim states so correctly, he says what happens so often is that when a person is involved in a law between man and God, so there's a tremendous amount, or at least there should be, a tremendous amount of passion, of enthusiasm. That piece of matzah has tremendous spiritual import. And sitting in the sukkah is a tremendous spiritual event. Lulav and Esrog, whatever it may be, Shabbos candles, we really can get into it. But laws between man and man, they just lack that same sense of divine imperative. We bring a cake to somebody, we help somebody out, do we feel it's like we're shaking a lulav and Esrog? Do we feel the same excitement? And generally speaking, not. And he explains that part of the reason for this is that when it comes to laws between man and God, so we realize that our intellect is limited, and this is what God commands us. Whether we understand why we should take an Esrog or sit in the sukkah, this is what we do. And we really suspend our mind to God. However, when it comes to the laws between man and one's fellow man, so one erroneously thinks that this is something logical. And therefore, we respond more on a level of logic than we do that this is what God commands. And because of that, we limit ourselves at times in really being able to perform an interaction between man and one's fellow man on the level that the Torah demands. A short story that comes to mind, which perhaps illustrates this idea. Don't recall the particular individual's names. It's a rather famous story 50 years ago, beginning of World War II, where, a little more than that, 60 years ago or so, we have a rabbi from the Musar Yeshiva, one of the Musar Yeshivas, who was raising money. And he came to stay at one of his former students' house in Baltimore. And the student was very excited to have his Rebbe, his teacher, in his house. And he immediately ushered him into the house. And he was talking to his Rebbe and walked into the living room. And the student's wife was listening to the radio in the living room. And as soon as he walked in with the Rebbe, and he immediately turned off the radio and continued talking to the Rebbe. So suddenly the Rebbe got all excited. He went out to the porch and he called the shamus and he was really, really upset. And the student didn't know what happened. And he said to the Rebbe, please tell me what happened. He said, I can't stay here. I just can't stay in a house like this. And he was really flustered. So the student said, please, please tell me. He said, no, I can't even stay here. I have to leave right now. The student said, well, what happened? He said, what a lack of sensitivity you have that here your wife was enjoying whatever show she was listening to on the radio, that you walked in and you felt that our conversation was more important than that which your wife was listening to. He said, that really lacked the sensitivity to where your wife was at. And further, now every time your wife sees me, she's going to feel embarrassed that she was listening to the radio. This is an example of what we mean, that in our mind, we think talking to this Rebbe is so far more important than a wife listening to the radio, so let's turn off the radio. It's far more important to listen to the Rebbe. But if we understand the sensitivity of Torah, we understand the sensitivity of people and where people are at. And that's the level we need to be at, not to be limited by our intellect. And truth be told, it's quite difficult, because what the Torah demands for us on a level of relationship between man and one's fellow man is at times superhuman. And we really need a lot of siyata d'shamaya, a lot of help from God. Very famous Sefer Chinuch, which illustrates this point. Sefer Chinuch on the law of not taking nekama, not taking revenge, notes. He says, at the root of the precept lies the purpose that a man should know and reflect that whatever happens to him, good or bad, is caused by the eternal God. Blessed is he to occur to him. From a human hand, from a man's brother's hand. Nothing can be without the will of the eternal Lord, blessed is he. in talking about Nekama, in talking about revenge, says the Sefer Chinuch, we normally look at revenge on a very narrow level. Somebody hurt me, I want to take revenge. But this is the point where we have to understand what the Torah demands of us is far beyond what we, in our simple minds, understand. And what happens so often is we confuse what we think is the proper mode of conduct with what the Torah demands of us, and then there's a lot of confusion. That's why, parenthetically, you have in so many yeshivas across the country, hundreds if not thousands of dollars spent on Derech Eretz program, and to make the children have better midos. And we don't see thousands of dollars spent on making the kids more Shomer Shabbos, keeping Shabbos, or keeping Kashrut. It's because we don't have this understanding. Shabbos Kashrut, that clearly comes from God. But we don't teach our children that midos comes from God too. How to act toward people, how to act toward parents, this is from the Torah. How to act toward teachers, this is from the Torah. This is what the Torah demands of us. The Torah has a demand for us very clearly of the way we act. And so, for example, in the law of Nekama, getting back to the Sefer Achinuch, he says that to look at Nekama as revenge, if somebody harmed me, you're missing the boat, it's a much larger picture. Kadosh Baruch Hu, God wanted this person to be the agent to do that which they have done against you. For the other is not the primary cause of his trouble, since it is sin that has brought it about. And we should understand that this is what God wants, and we have the ability to not take revenge, the ability to step back, and be able to forget and to forgive. And the model of this, and it's not easy, it's a model of David HaMelech, says the Sefer Chinuch. When Shimi ben Gera from the tribe of Benjamin came out, when David was fleeing from his son's Absalom's rebellion, Shimi came out and started cursing him, a klala nimretzet, a really a terrible curse, and threw little rocks at him. And David HaMelech's men were ready to take off his head. And David responded, no. So let him curse because the Lord had told him. He attributed the matter to a sin, not to Shimi ben Gera, and kept him alive. Moreover, continues the Sefer Achinuch, there is another great benefit resulting from this precept. It serves to stop contention, remove hate from the people's heart. And when there's peace among people, the eternal Lord grants them peace as well. This idea of understanding that the laws between man and one's fellow man require a tremendous amount of ability to understand what the Torah demands of us beyond our human intellect, and to be inspired by that which the Torah commands us, and really elevate ourselves to higher and higher levels. That, says the Matnas Chaim, is really one of the motifs within the Megillah, within the story of Esther. You know, so often we learn the story as children and we're set in a certain mold of what the story is about. It's very important to be able to step out and see the story from many different levels and see the many levels and layers the story is trying to teach us. And this says the Matnas Chaim, and this will be our first thesis of today, that the story of Purim is the story of Shalom. It's the story of peace. It's the story of midos. It's the story of character traits. It's a story of modeling on how to behave as people. Let's cite some examples where we see this in the Megillah. The first is in our introduction to Mordechai, a verse we say out loud when we read the Megillah. The verse tells us, beginning of chapter 2, there was a Jewish man, Ish Yehudi, in Shushan, the capital, whose name was Mordechai, son of Yair, son of Shimi, son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been exiled from Jerusalem along with the exiles, who had been exiled with Yechoniah, king of Yehuda, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel, had exiled. A very famous question is asked in the Talmud, is we seem to have an inner contradiction within our verse. Beginning the verse calls him an Ish Yehudi, a Hebrew, which literally means a man from Judah, from the tribe of Judah. The end of the verse is called Ishimini, a person from Benjamin. Well, which one is it? So one of the answers the Gemara gives is very interesting. The Gemara says, Omeret, Mishpachat Judah Omeret, the tribe of Judah says, Anagarin Dimisialid Mordechai Delokatle Dovi Lushimi Ben Gera, Mishpachat Binyamin Amri Minakati. The tribe of Yehuda says, in a sense, we're responsible for Mordechai. Why? because of the fact that David didn't kill Shimei. So now Mordechai, who's a descendant of Shimei, was able to be born. So a Benjamin is able to really call him theirs in terms of he was from Shevet Binyamin, from the tribe of Benjamin. He's also, in an effort, be able to overcome his natural inclination of nekama, of revenge. The story therefore begins off with our clear understanding of we're dealing with people who are trying to teach us what midos for proper behavior is about. Continues the Matnas Chaim, and he says, then the next verse in describing Mordechai, it's Asher Hoglam Yushalayim, that he was exiled from Jerusalem. And the word exiled is mentioned many times. The Talmud states that at a certain point, Mordechai exiled himself. He went back to Israel and then went back into Golos and to exile himself. And there are many reasons offered. He could teach Torah, etc. Targum Sheni, which is a very famous Aramaic translation, gives a different interpretation. It says that it's connected with the following verse of Ahi Omenet Hadassah, that he really raised and took care of Hadassah, who did not have a mother and father. Says the Targum Sheni, Ki Amar Tovli Lalechet Begolah Ve'yeh Omen LeEsther Meyot Be'eretz Yisrael. Mordechai said, it's better that I should go and leave Eretz Yisrael, leave Israel with everything that it entails and all the wonderful things that is there in order to be able to take care of this Yisoma, to take care of this orphan. This is the level of type of personality and sensitivity that we are dealing with, where people forgo personal pleasures for a higher order, for a higher understanding. And the Sfas offers such a wonderful insight into the character of Mordechai, which just drives this point home. And the verse that every day Mordechai would walk through the Chatzar Beit HaNashim, through the house of the woman, Ladat et Shlom Esther, to see how Esther was doing, Uma Yaseba, what was happening with her. So explains the Sfas Emes, it wasn't one day, it wasn't 2 days. For 5 years, Mordechai went daily to check on Esther. Why? Such a beautiful Sfas Emes. Mifnei she yitoma haita, because she was an orphan. The ratzala teila hargasha sheina bodedet sham umipnei schudze zachalanez. And Mordechai did not want to give her the impression that she was alone in the palace, that there was no one looking out for her, that no one cared for her. Every day he came to check on her. And this is the reason, says the Sfas Emes, that they were worthy having the miracle come through them. This is the midos, the way the Torah portrays it. And this is, says the Matnas Chaim, really the theme of the Megillah, to show us people of this stature. And the Megillah ends the same way. One of the last verses for Mordechai the Jew, the last verse, was viceroy to King Achshverosh. He was a great man among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brethren. He sought the good of his people, was concerned for the welfare of all his posterity. To which the Ibn Ezra says, seeking the good, he was Doresh Tov, he did not wait until asked, he actively sought opportunities to do good. Very often government officials wait till they're asked, till they're given petitions. Mordechai went out to see Doresh Tov Lamo, how could he be helpful? This is the model. As Matnas Chaim explains, the Megillah is not just a model of proper midos. As Rabbeinu Yerucham writes in Das Chochma Musar, the story of the Megillah is really zel umazel, one paralleling the other. It's to really contrast the personality of a Mordechai and Esther, who went above and beyond, who understood that midos, good quality traits, is not just what our minds dictate, but what God dictates, is to compare it to the personality of Haman. And throughout the Megillah, we have so many examples of Haman, of Achashverosh, of so many people who do not possess positive quality traits. We take a look at Haman, for example. We find him, Vayimalei Haman Chema, he's filled with anger. He's filled with gaiva, with a lot of pride, if people aren't going to bow down to him. He has everything in the world, all the glory, all the honor, except Mordechai not bowing down to him. He says to his family, V'cholze eno shovele, it's worth nothing to me. This is what we call people who lack midos, people who lack good character traits. Now we can understand why we say the Shoshanas Yaakov. The Shoshanas Yaakov is to really bring home to us, and this is one of the messages of Purim, we need to compare and contrast the Mordechai to the Haman, the Esther to the Zeresh. But now it's quite clear, says the Matnas Chaim, While by Haman it's Bikesh La'abdi, he who sought to destroy, it's enough to say Mordechai HaYehudi. Because that word HaYehudi, the fact that it comes from Yehuda, from David HaMelech, who's able to show superhuman efforts in not killing Shimei, that's the model of Mordechai, that's the model of the Jew, that's the balance. The Bikesh La'abdi is a model of bad midos, of bad character traits. The Yehudi says it all, the model we stand for as a Jew, as an Erlich person, a midos, this is what the Torah demands of us. The final idea of the Ma'anat Chaim on this section before we move to the second level is why is it specifically in the story of Purim that we learn about proper midos, proper character traits, the concept of shalom, of peace. So it got a very beautiful insight of the Chafetz Chaim based on a sentence we say every day in our davening in the Sim Shalom and the blessing for peace. We ask God, through the light of your countenance, you gave us, Hashem, our God, the Torah of life and of love of kindness. So ask the Chofetz Chaim, what's the relationship between the Torah of life and the love of kindness? Chofetz Chaim says so beautifully. The time when the Jews received the Torah, the heavens opened up and we clearly saw God. We clearly saw how God runs this world and we were very much taken by the concept of godliness and that there was no mitzvah, no existence aside from God. But we saw more than that. We saw the chesed, the kindness of God, how God really sustains the whole world. Notein lechem l'chol basar ki olam chasdo. He sustains all mankind because God's kindness is everlasting. And when we saw the heavens open up at the experience of Mount Sinai, we knew we wanted to emulate God and we knew we wanted to be involved in acts of kindnesses. But the experience of Mount Sinai was an experience on a very lofty level. It was an experience of the desert, experience of the Jews reading from the man and drinking from the well. The re-acceptance of the Torah in the time of Mordechai and Esther is to take these lofty ideas and bring them down to earth. It's to give us models of a Mordechai and Esther on how to behave. That the Torah, the re-acceptance of the Torah, is not just the re-acceptance of half of the tablets between man and God. But it's really both sides of the tablets. It's the reacceptance of our relationship between man and one's fellow man. Seeing the primacy of chesed, of doing good to other people. Seeing how there's a greater system in this world than perhaps we understand. And that's why on Purim, which is a time to reaccept the Torah, time to re-embrace the Torah, it's to re-embrace the totality of the Torah. And to be able to take our mindset, the way we view interpersonal relationships, and be able, just like as we do in between laws, between man and God, be able to do that between man and man, and be able to see what the Torah demands of us in terms of interpersonal relationship, not our own minds. Now we can clearly understand why Purim is a time of gift-giving. It's a time when we give to poor people without asking questions. You want money? How much money do you want? You want more money? No. It's a time of giving. It's a time of love. It's a time of suspending our logic. And that's why, as we saw by Rabbi Rucha, that's really a time to give mishloach manot to people perhaps who we're not on best terms with. Because it's a time to go over our midos. It's a time to become mention. It's a time to put those differences aside. Give a beautiful mishloach manot. Say, let's make up. Let's be able to begin again, renew our relationship, renew our friendship once again. And this is the Simcha of Purim. It's a Simcha of Avas Chesed. It's a Simcha of loving kindness. It's a Simcha of being able to share and be able to develop our midos, our sense of giving to other people, our sense of love, of friendship, of going beyond our seichel, beyond our logic, and just this over-expanding aspect of giving. As the Shulchan Aruch writes about Mishloach Manot, V'chol Amarbe Harezeh Meshubach. The more we give, the better it is on Purim. The more gifts we give, the more we are growing as people in the sense of love and friendship to others, modeling after Mordechai and Esther, and people who are models of proper midos, of proper character and behavior. That's the first level. The second level, which we'll do very briefly, perhaps offers a complement to this first level. If the first level is making ourselves into better people, to working on being a mensch, a ben adam l'chaveiro, the second aspect perhaps uses the mishloach manor to matanos lavyonim as a springboard in our relationship with God. The Gvoros Yitzchak of Avram Yitzchak Saratskina that tells Yeshiva notes that the archenemy in the Purim story, as we know, is Haman from the tribe, from the origin of Amalek. And we know that the first time we meet Amalek is after the Jews are in Refidim, and they question, Hayesh Hashem bekebenu imayin, is God among us or not? Immediately, Vayavo Amalek, Amalek comes. And we're familiar with the famous Rashi, based on the Medrash, that characterizes the Jews doubting God as the parable of a child on its father's shoulders who says to the father, Abba, please give me this object, Abba, please give me that, and the father's giving the child everything. And then the child sees a stranger and says, could you please tell me where my father is? And the father says, you don't realize I've been giving you all these things. He puts the child down, and the dog comes to bark him, which is Amalek. On this, our rabbis say, because the Jews were kfuyei tova, they did not appreciate God, they lacked gratitude. So a nation which exemplifies and is characterized by of people who do not show gratitude, who are kfuyei tova, will come and attack you. And that's Amalek, who comes from Esau, who clearly has this character trait. And it's very interesting that the Medrash really personifies Amalek as a dog. Let the dog come and bark and bite you. It's interesting because we have another personality later on in the Bible, 25th chapter of Shmuel Aleph, of Samuel 1, who clearly represents someone who's kfui tov, who shows a lack of gratitude. And that's Abigail's husband, Naval, who David HaMelech, before he became king, takes care of his sheep and takes care of his shepherds and protects them. And then when Nabal's having a sheep shearing party, David says, could you please share some food with me? And Nabal responds with real audacity, who is David? Who does he think that I'm going to give him food? And there the Navi describes Naval v'hu kalabi, which some understand it from the house of Kalev, others understand it as a dog, because he has this aspect of a dog. What is this aspect of a dog that Amalek is called this, Naval is called this? It's the aspect, our rabbis say, that you can almost hear in a dog's bark, hav hav, give, give. It's the aspect of always taking, 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 taking more and more and more, and wanting more for oneself without sharing for others. And such a philosophy breeds ingratitude. And we see this very famous idea of Rabbi Dessler, brought down in Strive for Truth in English by Rabbi Carmel, he says in Volume 1, what is the nature of gratitude and thanksgiving? What is the origin in the human psyche? He says, here too you may recognize the giver and the taker. The giver feels profoundly that he must reject free gifts. The desire of his being is to give, not to draw to himself things that are outside of him. Consequently, when he does receive anything from anyone else, he is immediately prompted to give something equivalent in return. If he is unable to do this in kind, his heart urges him to repay by giving happiness to that person by way of thanks and appreciation. The taker, on the other hand, wants only to draw to himself as much as he can, whether by robbery, deceit, or other ways of getting something for nothing. In his heart of hearts, he believes that everything is his, everything and everyone are there for his sake. When he receives some favor from his friend, he consequently does not feel any obligation to repay it. He takes it for granted that people should do things for him. He is thus by nature ungrateful. Gratitude may be on his lips, but it's not in his heart. It becomes clear, therefore, that his gratitude is also taking, since this is its object. To sum up, true gratitude derives from the power of giving, while ingratitude is spawned by the power of taking. Rav Dessler continues by saying that we know the true service of God is built on the foundation of gratitude. It's our duty to be thankful to God for all the good he bestows on us. And that's the first of the Ten Commandments. Remember that God took you out of Egypt from the house of slavery. It's intended to arouse in us feelings of gratitude as a prelude to our acceptance of God's Torah. The Jew by nature begins off the day mode, the ani, saying thank you to God. When the Jew shows this lack of appreciation for God, when he says to the stranger, well, where is God? Hayesh Hashem b'kibbeinim ayin, is God among us or not? So the nation which represents people who by their very nature are takers, exemplified by the dog, the kelev, hav, hav, give me more and more and more, they're the ones going to attack the Jews to remind them the Jew's job is to give, and through giving you come to feel gratitude and appreciation. With this we can understand that clearly if Haman is being sent against the Jews, so we find in the Megillah, we find at that period of time, the Jews are suffering from a similar symptoms. In fact, this is what the Beis HaLevi says in Parashat B'Shalach, that when Esther heard that Mordechai was in sackcloth, she sent her messenger Hasach and commanded him concerning Mordechai to find out what this was and about what this was. And the rabbi is puzzled by all this is in the sentence. She said, Esther, to him, Mordechai, never has Israel been in such distress. Perhaps the Jews have transgressed, this is my God, and I will beautify him, and the tablets of the covenant on this side and this side they were inscribed. And Mordechai responded that all that happened to him, Karahu, Mordechai said to Atach, the grandson of the one who encountered you, Karcha, on your journey, has come against us. Mordechai is clearly saying to Esther, why do we deserve this? Because we have the same problem that happened originally when the first Amalek came to attack us. It's this aspect of being Kfuye Tova, do not feel this gratitude to God. It was exemplified, as our rabbis tell us, the Gemara Megillah, that they bow down to the Tzelum, they bow down to the image in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, a denial of God. And the whole imagery of eating at the Suda, eating at the party, is this imagery of taking, taking, and taking. Eating from the same kalim, from the same vessels that were taken from the Beis HaMikdash. Without the sensitivity of being grateful to God, complete show lack of the sensitivity. And that's why it's not an accident that the famous Kapitel 22, chapter in Psalms that describes Esther's plea to God before she enters into Ahasuerus' inner kingdom, she says to him, rescue my soul, in verse 21, from the sword, my essence from the grip of the dog. She understands that we're up against the dog, we're up against this philosophy, and the Jews really are at fault. And that's why it says, the Gevurah Yitzchak, that the perfect antidote of this problem is Mordechai. And once again, how is Mordechai characterized as the Ish Yehudi? It explains that what does the Yehudi mean? The Yehudi means in the Targum is Gavar Chasida Umalda, someone whose ability, Lahodos LaHashem, to be able to thank God. We have a number of cases in the Megillah, like when Mordechai comes back to the Shar HaMelech after riding on the horse, he again thanks God, again davens to God, prays to God. Mordechai is this model of Yehudi Lahodos to thank God. It's the perfect balance, Bikesh La'abdi, Haman just tries to destroy, it's the Kelev, it's the taker. Mordechai, by saying Yehudi, is that perfect balance. He is the one who shows appreciation to God. He's always being Moda, always thanking God. Esther, we know, as the Sforno points out in Shemot, 18th chapter, Esther is the one who listens to all that Mordechai says because she feels so grateful for all that he has done for her. This feeling of gratitude, this feeling of thanking God, this is the model of Mordechai and Esther, which become the balance for the story of the sins of the Jews. Being able to say to the Jews, we need to focus in on what are the rudiments of our faith. It's the aspect of gratitude, of appreciating all that God has given us. And that's a reacceptance of the Torah on Purim. The reacceptance of the Torah on Purim, as we've described in the Gra, is MS, is truth. Because if we come down to it on the level of truth, we understand that we owe God so much. We need to acknowledge how much God has done for us in our lives. Purim is the time to reawaken within ourselves that relationship with God. To be able to step back and say, God has done so, so much for me. Am I as grateful as I should be for all God has done for us? On our own lives, how can we go through Purim as a day of reaccepting the Torah on the level of emes, of truth, of recognizing all the kindnesses God has done in our lives? Says the Gevurah Yitzchak as a final point, how can we inculcate gratitude in our lives? So he says, once again, based on a rabbi has said, whoever is ungrateful for good done to him by his friend will eventually prove ungrateful for the good done to him by the Holy One. And he quotes the Reb Nachum Velvel of Kelm by saying that every human being is swayed in all his actions by his characteristic qualities. If he is irritable, he will become angry in every situation which contains a stimulus to anger. And we know people like that. If that's their being, no matter what it is, it's going to spark them off. If he's arrogant, he will act arrogantly in every appropriate situation. Similarly, if he's good-hearted, he'll be good to everybody. If selfish, this will emerge in all of his dealings. No one can ever beg or borrow from his neighbor a character trait that he happens to need at a particular moment. So an ungrateful person will be ungrateful not only in his dealings with his fellow human being, but also in his relationship with the divine source of all being. And we know people like that. They're never happy people. And these people are never happy with what God's given them. Why did God do this to me? Why doesn't he give me this? We know such people. Once his trait is ingrained in his character, it will take charge of all his behavior and permeate all his attitudes, even when he's standing before God. On the other hand, one who acquires and fosters the precious quality of gratitude to others will not only give thanks to God, but will feel with all his heart and soul how much he owes him for all the manifold bounties he has received and continues to receive every day of his life. As we saw in Rav Dessler, the way to really bring about this gratitude with other people and ultimately to God is through the aspect of giving. The more we give, the more we appreciate others, the more we have this sense of gratitude to all that is done for us in this world. We're not interested in taking, we're interested in giving. And therefore, says the Gevurah Yitzchak, it's clear why on Purim we're involved in aspects of giving more so than any other holiday. Because Purim is the time to remind us where we messed up. We messed up in gratitude toward God. We messed up, and therefore Amalek, the dog, had to come and remind us. They who represent Kfuyei Tova, who do not show this gratitude, had to remind us what life is about. Mordechai is a Yehudi to thank God. Giving on Purim. Anyone who, Halacha tells us, who extends his hand, we have to give tzedakah to them. No questions asked. The more Mishloach Manot we do, the better, because we're involved in a day of giving, 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 giving. This aspect of giving has to arouse within us gratitude toward others, and ultimately that gratitude toward others extends to opening ourselves up to gratitude as God. And that's the experience of Purim. It's the experience of re-accepting the Torah of God and really re-accepting it on the level of appreciating all that Hashem has done for us. If we're able to summarize what we have seen, a lot of ideas. Why is Yehudi, second question, the balance for Bikei Shel'Abdi, one who sought to destroy us, because he's from the tribe of Judah and he's a model of Midos, of the correct character traits. The second level, the paradigm of a Jew, it's the ability to thank both of these levels, is a perfect balance of the poor Midos and the taking aspect of Haman. Why do we give Mishloach Manot on Purim? So the general reasons is the ordinary has to cut into the extraordinary. It has to be the unity which to counter this disunity, the level of Yom Kippur, the level of peace. On a deeper level, what we need to think about when we give Mishloach Manot on Purim, and thank God we give a lot of Mishloach Manot, we have many opportunities to think about this, is to inculcate proper character traits within us, to be people who are givers, to not just stand on ceremony, give to people, maybe not only our best friends, but people who we have a less of a relationship with, to extend ourselves above and beyond, to give to many poor people, to break out of our natural character state, and to understand there's a higher level demanded of us by God, those letters that are really standing out on the second part of the Luchos. And on the second level, giving Mishloach Manot, giving breeds gratitude. That's the emet, that's the truth of what Torah is all about, how God has done so much for us. And we need to feel so much gratitude toward God. Purim is that day, many days, it should be of every day, but to remind us of how much we owe God and to really try to breathe this character trait within us by having a day spent on giving. And therefore we can understand the joy which is inherent in Purim. On the first level, it's a joy of loving kindness, the joy of helping other people. On the second level, it's the joy of appreciating the kindnesses of God. And on both levels, whether it's our relationship to others and our relationship to God, Purim has to be a day that we walk in different than we walk out of it different than we walked in. Purim has to be the day that's going to change us. It has to be a day that we're going to re-accept the Torah. We re-accept the Torah on both levels, between man and fellow man, of understanding the importance of how to act according to the way the Torah demands of us with other people, and to appreciate all that God has done for us, and that also inspires us to keep the mitzvot between man and God as well.